You are listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 31st of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Fine art, sharp clothes, a rarefied German perspective on the art of the weekend, and a look through the lens at what makes for excellent photojournalism. We're across the world of print for this 53rd edition of The Stack. Also this week, we get an insider view on two titles that have become top of their game. We also cross to Cologne to meet a man who takes his weekends rather seriously.
This is kind of a dream job because we are our own bosses. We can do whatever we want. If we don't like anything, we just don't do it. So we are really independent, really free.
Here, here, and from Westphalia to Western Australia, we'll also be meeting the people behind a publication that puts a bit of street into the bush.
You know, a lot of the times you want to start something cool like a t-shirt label or a magazine. And we started chatting, and then the next day we thought, nah, let's just actually do this, you know? Let's not just be drunkards talking about having dreams.
And we'll be touching down in the south of France, where the best of the best in the world of photojournalism are currently gathering.
I'm always a little bit suspicious about citizen journalists, you know? We get many, many, many pictures from Syria by unknown people, and you never know who took them.
All that and much, much more today ahead on The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brulé. Well, as events in Syria continue to dominate screens and front pages, we start today in Perpignan, where the Visa pour l'Image festival is currently getting underway. Now celebrating its 25th year, the festival of the best in photojournalism brings together editors, agents, media owners, and of course photographers to discuss and dissect the art of telling stories through a perfectly trained lens. Earlier, I caught up with the organizer and founder, Jean-François Leroy. Mr. Leroy, it's another year. It's also another series of conflicts. And let's focus on two. Of course, we have Syria before us, but there's also the conflict on newsroom floors all over the world. And I'm not sure if this is an unprecedented year or not, but we've seen so many photo desks closing down where, you know, many venerable newspapers are not commissioning original photography like they used to. In the quarter century that you've been doing the festival, is this unprecedented in your opinion, and do you see this as a crisis?
I'm always saying that there is no crisis really in photojournalism, because photographers are producing stories. Unfortunately, magazines use the stories less and less. That's the point. You know, so about the conflict in Syria, for example, it's very difficult to cover, as you know. Many photographers and journalists and cameramen were killed. But I think we have to open our eyes, because what is happening in Syria is a real danger for all the world.
Indeed, we were speaking to someone from a new type of media operation earlier in the week, who talk about, yes, they get a lot of imagery, they're trying to use a lot of pictures off of social media, but also, you know, the trouble of really trying to sift through, yeah, the accuracy, the validity of all of these things. So, you know, when we see photo editors being retired, put out to pasture early, that budgets are being cut, well-recognized newspapers are happy to just use photos from citizen journalism. What is going to give at this point when you can't offer journalists or photojournalists proper coverage like they had once upon a time, in some places?
I'm always a little bit suspicious about citizen journalists, you know, because when you are speaking to a professional journalist, you are supposed to know your source. And we get many, many, many pictures from Syria by unknown people, and you never know who took them. So I'm always very suspicious about that. You know, I have to confirm my information. I have to know where is my source, who is my source.
Indeed, and doesn't this cut to the heart of the problem when so many newsrooms don't really care, or would seemingly don't care, because they're happy to take these images and put them on their pages, put them on their websites? What do you think has to give for the situation to change, where we see a situation where people do care about the validity of not only where did this picture come from, but also, you know, who was the person who was actually pressing the shutter as well?
Everybody has a camera now in your smartphone, in your everywhere. You have some pictures. You can take some pictures. But it's not because my picture is good technically that it means something. You know, and the difference between all the bad pictures that we see all over the network, many of them are good, a few of them are good, but the huge majority of them is a nightmare.
Tell me, just looking at this year's festival, I imagine there were no shortage of as you were rightly saying, I guess, as well, entries from Syria, and probably many that you were not really able to corroborate where they were from. What stands out, though, so far in terms of entries for this year?
You know, I really love the work for, you know, I have to mention Don McCullin, because this retrospective is so big, so huge, so wonderful that you have to see it. But besides that, you know, we make a show with João Silva, you know, this South African photographer born in Portugal, who is working for the New York Times, and who lost his two legs 3 years ago in Afghanistan. And his strength, you know, the way he's facing life without his legs, is absolutely outstanding. So, you know, to me, to have this show from João Silva is a privilege, because, you know, I was speaking with him yesterday night about the role of photojournalism in the press of today. And, you know, I said more and more people are pretending that there is no more space for such pictures. And he looked at me very seriously and he said, you know, if somebody tells you that photojournalism has no future, just he has to tell me face to face, because I lost my legs for that. And I was really overblasted.
That was Jean-François Loa there from the Visa pour l'Image festival, which is getting underway today in Perpignan in France. I'm joined also in studio by two editors. One, a familiar face who's been here before, Charlotte Ray. Very good to see you. We'll come back to you in a moment, though, because we always want to introduce newcomers around the table. Sam Thorne is the associate editor at Frieze Magazine, a tutor at the Royal College of Art, and co-founder of the Open School East, a free-to-attend art school in Hackney, which opens this September. We want to talk about that in a moment, but just wanted your reflections on listening to Mr. Loa, and this ongoing and of course very topical discussion at the moment. You know, we see Syria very difficult to get images out. So many of the images that we do see, of course, are generated off of mobile phones and elsewhere, and without and a lot of trouble in terms of actually, you know, verifying where all of this comes from. When you look at news outlets, and be they, you know, electronic or on paper, do you cast your eye across the page in a different way when we see, I guess, more grainier images than we used to? Once upon a time, we would have just had the report from the correspondent, but it almost seems necessary that we have the image to go with the story now.
Yeah, I think inevitably you look more and more for the source, and that's often there in the fabric of the image itself, right? The kind of the graininess, you know, it gives a sense of the citizen journalism, the kind of source of the thing. But this kind of issue of the veracity of images that's coming out of these zones of conflict, you know, this has always been there in terms of war photography. If you go back to Kappa or back to Matthew Brady, the possibility that things can be somehow staged or somehow not quite reflective of what exactly is going on, you know, that's obviously here in Syria. And you only had to look at these images coming in from yesterday of what seemed to be attacks of napalm-like substances, but there were claims and counterclaims being made about who was the source of these attacks.
Charlotte, And for those who maybe have not met you over the airwaves before, you're of course the co-editor of Acne Paper, and a title which gives a lot of great real estate, not just to fashion imagery, but also to great reportage as well. When you look at a front page of a newspaper, and you know it can sort of hail from any corner of the world, is your eye a little bit more skeptical than it would be before? You know, when we see so many user-generated images, then perhaps, let's say, you know, a byline from a recognizable photojournalist or a recognizable news agency, potentially?
I wouldn't say necessarily so. I think it's sort of a sign of our times that people who are there can send an imagery. And in a way, I think that's a positive thing. At the same time, I completely agree with the sort of dangers of that. You know, is this image staged? Who actually sent it in? And I completely agree with the sort of worries that comes from or with.
Mm. To both of you, I guess at a time when so many titles, of course, have budget constraints, etc., in one way, sort of you're in unified worlds, but also very different worlds as well. So much discussion on the editorial floor between, you know, those commissioning and those in the art side as well. How much you take in to put on page from the reader, from your constituents, as opposed to going out and doing, let's say, a traditional commission?
For us, I think the point at which our readers have more of a voice has been kept more online, and the magazine now, in some ways, really hasn't changed too much. The magazine is founded in 91, and I think in some certain formal ways, in terms of its structure, it really has remained quite similar. What has changed is that we brought in a blog about 5 or 6 years ago that all of the editors between London, Berlin and New York contribute to. And it's really those kind of formats, I think, where the discussion is being extended.
Mm. Sure. What about your, in also a rarefied world like yours as well? And, for you, has there been any sort of sense of pressure as to how much you sort of open up the pages? Of course, you're breaking new talent for sure. But, there always sort of seems to be that sort of, knock from someone in the background who says, everything that's happening in terms of user generated content, shouldn't it appear on your page? Or has that ever been a discussion at Acne Paper?
Not really, I must say.
You don't have to be embarrassed when you say that either.
I think we've chosen. I think we've chosen to have a very minimal online presence because we like to sort of keep the magazine as rare as possible. And as a sort of art book magazine, very little of what we commission is actually not used. If that makes sense, we're very sort of aware of our page count, and every image is thought about, discussed, thought about, put in. Edited, come back out. So no, is my answer to that.
Very good. We're talking to Charlotte Ray, editor or co-editor of Acne Paper, and also Sam Thorne, associate editor at Frieze Magazine. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Going away for a short break. When we come back, though, we're heading off to Germany for a bit of a weekender. And you are listening to The Stack, a publication that sets a tone and captured a certain mood, something that words alone cannot define, is something we're always keen on here at Monocle. A magazine from Cologne is one such title. The Weekender has set a calm, countrified, and ultimately stylish standard in new German publishing. Our contributor, Amy Zayed, went to The Weekender's office to meet its editor, Dirk Münkenmüller, to talk pages, print, and leisure time.
We started off 3 years ago, and I think the initial moment was when we first saw the Barcelona-based magazine Apartamento, and I think we were blown away that a magazine like this could look like this, dealing with interiors, with how people live, and not showing the usual stuff that the high-gloss magazines show, with fancy furnitures and stylish blazes. And I think we thought, this is something that could also work in Germany. So when we started, the idea was to make a mixture of interiors, how people live, and traveling. We didn't have like a really good concept that we started with. Some stuff happened almost by accident. So we called our friends, wrote many emails, and just saw what kind of stories, what kind of pictures and texts we could get our hands on, and just saw what we could make out of this.
What's the most unique story that you've done so far that you kind of liked and that you'd like to look back on saying, wow, that was a good thing to do?
One story is outstanding, I think. It was also a story that was hard work because it didn't happen very easily. I somewhere found a website from a guy called Zach Klein. He's a young guy from New York, and he's one of the founders of Vimeo. He has like a cottage, like a barn, in the forest outside of New York, where he goes with his friends, and they have like a adventure playground. They build a house, hang out there in the nature, and this was really nice pictures we saw on that blog. So we got in contact with him. He was a bit difficult, but in the end he was really nice. We asked him if he could hook us up with some pictures. Then I did an interview with him, and we made a great story out of that. Not an easy birth, but it worked out. And just some weeks ago, we heard that this particular cover won an award, which is quite known in Germany, called Lead Award. We started the magazine because we wanted to, and we enjoyed doing it, and just wanted to see if that could work out, that two regular guys that are involved with journalism and graphic design could start their own magazine. And yeah, it worked out. So we never really had a particular audience in mind. We are happy about anyone that enjoys the magazine. And I think in the beginning, most people that bought the magazine came from big cities like Berlin or Hamburg or Munich. But now, after almost 3 years, we have a lot of readers from small towns all over Germany, also of from other countries, of course. So it seems like the word is spreading. People from Japan, from wherever, get in contact.
But you don't have like any, you know, figures of how many people buy the magazine?
Of course.
Let me know.
Yeah, we started out really with a really small print run because we obviously didn't have much money. So I think we started with the first issue with 3,000 copies, and found out that it's really hard to sell 3,000 copies, but after some time they were gone. So then we printed 5,000, and right now we are printing 7,500, which is still not a lot compared to like most magazines in Germany that print much, much more and also sell more, of course, but we're getting there, I think. This is kind of a dream job because we are our own bosses. We can do whatever we want. Nobody from marketing or so gets to us and talks about any stuff. If we don't like anything, we just don't do it. So we are really independent, really free, and that's something we really enjoy also when we don't make big bucks from this.
Dirk Münkenmüller, editor of The Weekender, talking to Amy Zayed in Cologne. We're going to go away for a break, but just before that, I just want to get reflections on the magazine. Weekender is interesting to me because in the German market, it's only sort of quite recently that you've seen sort of the rise of even Sunday papers. There's, of course, traditionally been, of course, strong Saturdays, but not a very strong supplement culture in that market. I guess in many ways, because you have the strength of Stern and Focus on a Thursday, you've got Der Spiegel on a Monday, which have always sort of maybe filled more of that that role. Of course, we were passing around one of the recent issues, just listening to the piece. And Sam, I guess, Sam, your first sort of thoughts and comments on it. Is this sort of a curious German concoction that could only sort of, maybe come and fill a gap in a market in the absence of, let's say, traditional weekend supplements you might see in Australia, US, or the UK?
I don't think so. I mean, for me, it's certainly got some of the look of quite recent magazines that are coming out of the UK. I'm thinking of things like The Plant Journal or Gourmand. And these kind of things, you see them, what's notable for me going to Berlin is the just huge volume of independent publishing, like outlets, magazine shops they've been popping up in the last 5 or 10 years. And for me, it just looks like something that's really at home among that kind of market.
Mm. Charlotte, your thoughts on it?
I think it's really charming, and I love that it's sort of quite witty inside. But as you said, I think there's a quite, I think it sits really sort of beautifully within that enthusiasm for independent magazines in Germany. And you can almost see that in the typography as well, that there's this really nice heritage in terms of craftsmanship.
Yeah, I think what they managed to do as well is you know, I think as we're saying in the intro, it really sort of, you know, sets a tone and actually sort of does what it says on the label in many ways. Transferable, do you think? We've seen Kinfolk, for example, you know, launch a Japanese edition. Is this something that you could potentially see, you know, being snatched up elsewhere? Or do you think it sort of has to live within the borders of Germany? Or could it translate, do you think, and travel?
No, I think it could definitely translate. The question is what the competitors would be. I mean, in England, we have the Travel Journal, which is not the same, but it sort of lives in the same space.
Absolutely. I wouldn't bet against it transferring anytime soon. Yeah,
absolutely. We're going to take a very short break. You're listening to the Stack of Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the global pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, so much more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations, and stunning photography. We look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shiba Ken dog by your side, and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in good bookshops around the world and is also available to order now at monocle.com. Happy reading.
And you're listening to The Stack here on a Saturday on Monocle at 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. It's time now, of course, we were talking about to the weekend or just before we went away to the break as well. And Sam was talking about those great Berlin stores. And if anyone was, of course, struggling with a name that we were struggling with as well, we were talking about the very, very wonderful Do You Read Me as probably one of the best periodical outlets in the world, at least be my nomination anyway. Anyway, we looked at the Weekender. I thought... Sam, we probably sort of start with you, what you brought in today and sort of delve into titles that you want to discuss.
Absolutely.
New, old or otherwise.
Well, new and old is what I decided upon. And these
Very
were
good.
Really just the two publications that were on my coffee table this morning. And fortuitously, they turn out to be both New York-based, but both very, very different. The first of them is Bidoun magazine, which was founded, I think, 8 or 9 years ago in New York. And Bidoun is a magazine, as it says on the cover, that deals with art and culture from the Middle East, but it is not based in the Middle East. Bidoun in Farsi means without, and it's really their remit to look at what they call the industries of interest around the Middle East. So rather than looking at, say, Al Jazeera, they may have an interview with one of the presenters from Al Jazeera, for example, or this issue, the most recent one that I have with me, they have interviews with Larry Gagosian, the gallerist, about his Armenian heritage, or the actor who plays Abu Nazir in Homeland, for example. So the way in which the Middle East gets filtered out into the wider world is one of their projects that they've been following this last decade.
And for you, is it a pleasure read, or is it something as well that you're benchmarking yourself against as well when you think about the level that you have to perform at editorially?
It's a pleasure read for sure, but I mean, in terms of what they do, in terms of design, typography, it's really quite bold. Sometime after the first murmurings of the Arab Spring, they did a issue that was made entirely in Cairo. They moved their whole office from New York to Cairo and did it very cheaply, did a stapled together black and white version of the magazine. Mm. So they're very unafraid to break from the format that they've set themselves. And also, this is reflected by, in the early years, their foundation of something called the Bedouin Library, which is a touring project. And it's essentially a collection of pulp fiction, perhaps, collected from street markets in Cairo and Beirut and Alexandria over the course of the last 5 or so years. And that's been exhibited internationally at MoMA, New Museum. And I think it's in Munich right now, the Kunstverein.
That proximity issue is an interesting one, you know, being able to jump across the Atlantic from your editorial base and then be in the heart of things, in Cairo, when your brand in many ways has been established of course, in a liberal democracy, where you have, I think, the freedom of both observation and expression. Do you think it could only sort of exist? I think with that level of distance, or would it be a different magazine if it was based even in Paris, for example?
It would certainly be very different. It's for sure inflected by its New York base. And I think actually it's prehistory as a magazine. Many of the editors had a background working with Transition in Harvard, the kind of the journal for post-colonial studies. And so it really has that kind of Ivy League kind of tint to it, I think. And so a move to Western Europe, it would be an entirely different publication.
Mm. So Impressions, are you familiar with Bedouin? Or was it this first flick today? Or have you been following what they're up to?
It was my first flick today.
And sort of, I guess, Impressions and feel. I mean, the one thing that sort of strikes me is I think when they do these actually sort of quite lengthy Q&As sometimes is that they're actually able to, I think, do something typographically where they're able to let stories breathe. And actually, they may not sort of draw you in right away, but I think sometimes you can find a pop cue that wants to pull you into the story. But I guess first impressions.
I must say I'm quite the big fan of massive Q&As, because I think that if you let, you know, what you just said is sort of as a synopsis of the magazine sounds really interesting. And in terms of, it's a quite sort of unique choice to do for a magazine. And I think to be able to actually be able to explain that, to get to the depth of people and what they really have to say and sort of cover a wide range of subjects that sort of build a full image, you have to give people space. And you really have to be able to ask them all different things.
Absolutely. One of the things, I'm a fan of the long form interview anyway, but this is a very different kind of interview from the one you might think of, you know, in say the Paris Review that's put together over the course of many months or many years. The interview with Larry Hugosin in this issue seems to me to be completely unedited. So you have all of the ums and ahs. You have Gagosian's assistant coming in saying it's perhaps time to leave. And you also have him misunderstanding the interviewer when she's asking him about diaspora. And he doesn't seem to be aware of what that word means, but it's also not made quite clear in the interview whether he misunderstands or just really doesn't hear this mumbling interviewer. So I like that kind of the informality of a lot of the interviews, and it's really kind of granting another kind of angle onto some of these, onto the interviewees, onto the subjects.
And I think that's lovely, because not only do you get his answers, but you actually get a sense of his environment, who he is, and sort of, you know, his personality.
For sure.
Which I think really adds to an interview. I mean, a person is a human being and it's a subject, but it's also, you know, the person behind it, which is really interesting.
Mm. I mean, I was asking you a little earlier, Sam, about what you sort of measure and sort of gauge yourself against. And at Frieze, is there that sense when much loved titles come in that the team gathers round and has a look at something and say, you know, damn, you know, how did they do that? Or I wish we had done that. I mean, of course, you know, you're also in a very unique position given the Frieze brand. But is there that sense of benchmarking of a week, of a month, or when your issue comes out?
Perhaps, but I would say that generally we're maybe thinking slightly more historically, that when the magazine was founded in the early 90s, Matthew and Amanda, the co-founders, were looking at, in terms of a domestic market, they were looking at a magazine called Artscribe, which I think folded in around 91 and was really very influential for them. And some of the first people to be writing regularly for Frieze, like Stuart Morgan, were all people who had come up, cut their teeth, so to speak, on ArtScribe in the 70s and 80s. And it was magazines like that that they were looking to. And I think they started to wonder why a magazine like Art Forum wasn't paying attention of what was going on in London in the early 90s. And this was the early days of the YBAs, of course. Mm. And so I think looking at the high points of certain art publications, journals or whatever, and whether that's Aspen or whether that's Avalanche, that's one of the things that's always been very important for me. And I think what's kind of notable about that is that those magazines often don't last for very long. Mm. So what happens when you're something like Frieze and it's 20 or so years in? How do you rethink? How do you reshape?
And I guess and how much of is it also going back to sort of issues, you know, 2, 3, and 4 for you as well? I mean, your own archive.
It's right there. It's right next to our desk. It's something we consult often when we're trying to remember whether an artist has been on the cover before, for example.
Sure.
But it's always also telling to go back to those first 10 or 20 issues, and you have Damien Hirst on the cover of the pilot issue, the first ever butterfly painting he made. And this is when he would have been all of 23, I think. But then of those other first 10 issues, there are a number of the artists who you really probably wouldn't have seen so much over the last few years. Mm.
So you seem to be sort of nodding in some agreement. So is it sort of looking at, again, very hard for Acne Paper to have direct competitors, you would say. But is it always, I guess, you know, keeping on your toes by just paying attention to what's out there? Or is it always going back to the knitting of what you've established with your own print brand?
I mean, of course, we look back at what we have done for reference, but of course we're looking at publications. And I think maybe not so much like independent magazines, but maybe art books and what people are doing in terms of layouts and designs and who's coming up with who and what's doing what, because I think that's sort of closer to the world where we live. But yes, we have the same. We have our archive on a big wall next to us. And it's nice to see, not only for sort of reference of where we've been, but also to sort of keep a continuity in terms of personality and, you know, what is the essence of what we're doing.
I was just going to say, you've brought some other things in, and I always sort of feel we always run out of time in this program, and it's always the feedback we get that people want to get around, or at least crack some more spines of titles. So I'm going to ask you, which title do you want to discuss first today?
I would like to discuss this one, which is a food magazine called Fool, which is in English, but published out of Sweden, Stockholm and Malmö, which I think is a really lovely sort of food magazine based on the sort of people who are behind the food rather, and the personalities and the processes behind food rather than the actual sort of served product.
It's, you know, at the top of the show, we were talking about, you know, how you have this incredible movement in Germany where there are just, you know, so many titles, and it seems that, you know, the Germans are putting out, you know, there's more, it feels like there's more independent publishing there than anywhere else. But I was in Stockholm a couple of weeks ago and noticed, you know, we had one of the new beer magazines was on. I saw this when I was at Papercut as well. Do you think that the self-publishing movement is creeping across the Baltic a little bit more as well? That was my sense of it, but I'm not sure what when you sort of observe Sweden, what you're seeing as well.
No, absolutely. I think it's sort of part of this generalist movement, a sort of empowered movement in the sense that people say, I have something to say, let's make a magazine about it. And they do it well, like really well. And I think that, you know, some magazines obviously have bigger budgets and more people behind, but what often surprises me and what I get really impressed by is that there's a very small team of very passionate people behind it.
Absolutely. And I think you're seeing that maybe creeping across the Baltic, often because if you're looking at Berlin as a base for some of these things, most of the people who are working on magazines there perhaps aren't from Berlin. You know, so it's really only a matter of them going back to Stockholm, to Malmö. And, you know, so you're seeing these kind of shifts, these conversations going back and forth.
your impressions of that? I'm always amazed, you know, that it sort of seems we've had all of these food titles, for, you know, certainly out of this country, and of course many out of the United States as well. And just when you think there can't be yet another self-published, you know, food title, here's another one, and we can do, you know, we can do whiskey and we can do many other things. Sam, your impressions of it, because it's interesting. I think when I look at the typography of it, when I see Fool on the front, my feeling is that it slightly betrays, and I think in maybe in a positive way, what's really inside. I think sort of, you know, first glance, I sort of wonder if it could almost be a film magazine or something else. There's something very familiar about the, I don't know, the title layout, I think the construct of the masthead, and then, but then, yeah, you jump inside, it's something very different.
Or even a classic rock magazine. It has the look of the Rolling Stone fonts on the front. And I mean, it made me at a glance look like something like Mojo has had a redesign. But once you're inside, it's a very different story and much more restrained, for one thing. But also, I like their use of commissioned illustration, which I think really sets it aside from Lucky Peach, with the other kind of, you know, food magazine from a year or two back, which has a very different, I mean, say, kind of quite hyperactive approach to illustration. This is something else entirely, and I like it a lot.
And also in English, which is also helpful as well. A couple more titles to go through. We're also going to head to Australia in a moment as well. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
Who's that big, handsome thing getting all the looks on the beach, attracting envious glances by the pool and too many amorous advances in the sun-dappled cafe? That's right, it's Monocle Mediterraneo, our big, bold, large-format newspaper that reports from the sunnier southern European spots each summer. Our editors have been scouring ports on the rise and plage for pleasure to bring you a host of reads to enjoy with your Aperol this vacation season.
In the affairs section, we head to Rabat to discover why there was no need for an Arab Spring in Morocco. I check in with the mayor of Athens to discover how he's trying to rebuild his broken city. And our team of writers and editors provide the perfect Mediterranean reading with a host of essays about Wales, gelato and summer drinking.
In the business section, we visit southern Italy to see how community cooperatives are giving the mafia the boot. We survey the brands that are making waves in the Mediterranean and head to Liguria to check out how the region's historic boat builders are weathering the economic storm. We also add a little luxury into island hopping as we set sail on Monocle's very own ferry.
In the culture section, we visit Marseille's new museum district. Down by the port side, there's paintings. Plus, a banging summer playlist from some mighty musicians and a grand tour of the Med for the artistically inclined.
Make sure you get your copy of Monocle Mediterraneo. It's on newsstands now, or order a copy from monocle.com. You'll be the envy of all the lounger lizards.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said Brand Strategy Company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
A and you're with this 53rd edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Also, Acne Papers editor Charlotte Ray and Sam Thorne of Freeze magazine. Sam, at the top of the show, we talked about your new almost open to all art project happening out in East London. I thought this would be a good juncture for the show to tell us a little bit about it before we go to Australia.
Absolutely. Open School East is a free to attend art school that's opening next month for our pilot year. It's housed in a former public library in East London in De Beauvoir Town. And for our pilot year, we have 13 students aged between 21 and I think mid 40s. And we're really asking for no formal academic requirements. We put out a call for entry in spring and had about 300 people apply from all over the world. Our faculty includes everybody from Turner Prize winning artists like Elizabeth Price through to novelists and essayists like Brian Dillon. And it's entirely free. Studios are entirely free. They're all in the building. Tuition, which will be 2 days a week from now until August, is also free. Much of this will be open to the public. We launch on 16th of September, and I would love everybody to drop by.
Mm. And of course, then it demands the question, how does funding work then for this?
Funding for us, the initial funding is from the Barbican, from a department they have called Creative Learning, which is split between the Barbican and Guildhall schools. And it's to look into radical forms of pedagogy. So about 90% of our funding is coming from them. The other 10% from Create, who commission artist-led projects in East London. And that's for the first year. And aside from that, we're looking for further funding from private sources.
OK, well, be careful what you wish for. You never know how many people are going to pile in. So middle of September, we're going to head a little bit further east from Hackney. Actually, we're heading to West Australia. For a long time, the state of Western Australia was known for little more than its booming mining industry and, of course, enviable beaches. But over the past two decades, this isolated region has evolved into a cultural powerhouse, exporting critically acclaimed bands and in-demand cinema starlets. It's also getting a reputation for its print scene, in particular, the locally run contemporary art magazine King Brown has built a global following for its vibrant design and irreverent interviews. Now in its ninth issue, the magazine is a breath of fresh air in a sometimes overly earnest genre. Well, to find out more about the publication in the Little Brown Bag, our Adrian Craddock spoke to King Brown's co-founder, Ian Much.
Yeah, I live in a little isolated sort of surf coastal town in southwest WA, Western Australia, a place called Dunsborough. It's kind of cool, low population, good for the creative juices. As I say, I try to travel whenever I can, but as far as my little cubby house down there, it's just a really good spot to be free and just design and do art.
And not too far from there, in the city of Perth, you guys started this magazine, King Brown. Can you tell us how that all happened?
Basically, the story goes, it's we all got pissed at a party one night. We were mates out of university and, you know, a lot of the times you want to start something cool like a t-shirt label or a magazine. And we started chatting, and then the next day we thought, nah, let's just actually do this, you know. Let's not just be drunkards talking about having dreams. And we went for an arts grant, got awarded that, and then issue one came along and kind of stemmed from there.
Let's start with the title, because I, being a local from this state, I know what it means. But can you explain to our listeners what King Brown actually means?
Well, King Brown, it's slang for a long neck, and in Australia, a long neck or a King Brown is basically a large bottle of beer. It's kind of like a Friday night, you go down to your bottle-o, you get a large beer, it's wrapped in a brown paper bag, and you kind of keep it in that bag like a bit of a stubby holder, and, you know, off you go to your favourite skate spot or your house party or whatever.
And with the bag, I mean, it's probably one of the most defining things about the aesthetic of the magazine. Is that also kind of a commercial thing? I mean, it kind of builds this sense of mystique because it's sealed at the top. It's got this kind of stitching at the top, which means you can't kind of flick through it in a newsagent's. So, I mean, is that an intentional thing?
Yeah, I guess it's the hand-created look that we like. We've played around with a few ideas. We actually had one issue where we stuck the top of the bag down and it just didn't work the same. We really liked the hand-stitched, the finished product. I mean, it's a very handmade kind of magazine, you know. We're low run, we're more special, a lot of love goes into each issue. All the contributors send the great art, quality art. And the bag itself, in a newsagent or in a bookstore, it really stands out from any of the others. And also, just by default now, I guess, well, I hope people see it and know it's King Brown magazine because they see the brown paper bag. So straight away, it's identifiable, and to us, it's worked well marketing-wise. The only hindrance, of course, is that some people who may not know would need to see a reader copy, and that would need to be removed from the bag. So many times with a stockist, especially if they're ordering lots, we'll provide a reader copy because it's essential for people to see too.
Mm-hmm. And with every issue, you guys are up to issue 9 now, mm-hmm. you seem to include these pretty awesome, I don't know what you call them, like trinkets or you know, these kind of little extra pieces. I think in this issue it's, is it a stubby holder? Or?
Yeah, we call them inserts. I mean, for want of a better word, I guess. That's another thing with the brown paper bag. It allows us to put some extra goodies. And with these inserts, they normally involve the artist from within the issue. For this one, yeah, stubby holder, some hand-typed treatment from Roach, and the sticker by Dabs Myler. I guess it just matches their contribution to issue 9 as well. In the past, we've done all sorts of crazy ideas. We really want to push it more and more. I guess it's a fun little task each time a new issue comes out is thinking, all right, what sort of inserts are we looking at this time, you know? I guess, to be honest, the only restriction we always think about is weight and keeping it fairly flat because obviously, you know, you need to ship these things around the world.
Yeah, so. It definitely makes it kind of more of an event when you open this thing. Like, make it more of an event, I guess, is really important. Is that something that you guys have thought about?
Yeah, like I said before, it's kind of, we're not selling anything. We're just basically commenting on art at where it is at the moment. Our initial intentions was to have local artists teaming up with the big guys from around the world and display them on some, you know, nice crisp quality paper. The inserts themselves out of the bag, I guess it's just another little bonus for our readers to get. And just to remind them to have fun with everything, because often art is taken so seriously too. And, you know, I guess if street art, if you want to call it that, it's always been in the public eye and it's available to anyone. So to open a bag and just get some goodies and have a laugh and enjoy it is kind of what we're all about. And that's also, it stems from having things like our events which go with the magazine. You know, we have a party, we like to show things there, obviously showcase the magazine and have live art at the same time.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So obviously the magazine, as you said, was founded in Perth, but it's really gained a bit of an international following. Every time you release one of these, how do you decide where to have these parties around the world? Because there's one in New York at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, New York's been great. My King Brown partner, York, he now lives over there. So without a doubt, it's been awesome for him to be on the ground there, make friends with new artists, heaps of networking. So it definitely comes from that. The other main reason is, of course, distribution. You know, once we get this magazine out there and try to gain more readership, it makes sense to have a party or a launch where people can come and enjoy it. We invite store owners, distributors, and all sorts. I mean, to be honest, I'd love to have one in London, Tokyo, these kind of places next. We've just done Sydney as well. This latest issue was co-created by The Hours from Sydney. Great lads, Roach, Beastman, Numbskull, some great artists. And those guys, along with their friends, had a Sydney launch just last week. So we had New York and then Sydney, and we're going to do Singapore next month. Just some key locations around the world that really help to network more, branch out, and gain more readership.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty ambitious. I mean, when you compare that to, you know, some other kind of local art magazines, what are your hopes for King Brown? Do you see it becoming an international brand?
Yeah, I guess so. We never really think about it that hard, to be honest. I think it's also the fact that the Ock and myself just really enjoy traveling. People we hang with, they're obviously great travelers. They do all sorts of street art around the world, and that's what it's all about. Just getting yourself out there. I suppose the same for King Brown. It's not fully intentional to take over the world or anything crazy, but you know, it's just, we like to travel, and if we can have some cool launches around the world, then it's all a bonus.
When you were setting up the magazine, did you draw inspiration from anything else that was out there? I mean, any other publications?
Yeah, some magazines at the time, Lucky Magazine from Melbourne, Archetype, Refill, those kind of magazines. These days, even influences of big magazines, big guys like Monster Children, Lowdown, of course, they've been a big one. There's some great magazines out there. I guess the other thing changing now is the fact that, you know, a lot of people say print is dying and that sort of thing. We've talked about going online a bit more, but in saying that, just the whole hands-on, you know, a sewn brown paper bag with some quality inserts and some fun that you can actually hold in your hands, I guess, you know, I think that'll never die. It's always good for us, and it's fun too.
I think you can say that's a publisher and editor having a very good time. Ian Much, co-founder of the Perth-based art magazine King Brown. He was speaking to our Perth-based Adrian Craddock. I think we were all sort of smiling at various points. I mean, turn of phrase probably more than anything else. You haven't seen a copy, have you, Sam? I haven't. We're waiting. This is the problem, of course, when you get stories commissioned in Western Australia, despite UPS and everything else. Of course, the story can arrive digitally, but we don't see the magazine. Intrigued, though?
I'm very intrigued. I'd love to see a copy. I like the line, we didn't want to be drunkards with dreams. It's a good ethos for publishing.
Charlotte, I couldn't sort of tell when you were listening whether you wanted to sort of, you know, to meet Ian much or you wanted to see the magazine.
Both. I think that the magazine seemed to be a product of a really sort of great energy and love from a very fun group of people. So, yeah.
Excellent. We don't have too much time left, but we're on your side of the table, Charlotte. I guess time for one more magazine then before we go today.
So this is the new magazine called ANU, and it's the new magazine of the group behind Tar Magazine. So this is their new sort of art and fashion venture, which is very lovely sort of art magazine where they've given creatives around the world really beautiful space to sort of create freely in print form, which sort of includes contributions by Faye Toogood, who's London-based, in a really beautiful sort of like silver print, and they have some really nice sort of postcard story in here, and they've really sort of taken out the turns in terms of what you can do in print, which is really nice, mixing materials, etc.
Are you familiar with it?
I'm not familiar with it, no. How does it differ from Tar? What's the, how does the approach differ, Charlotte, do you know?
I think this is sort of just a younger version, but I think I would say that the sort of creative is slightly more Europe-based, maybe. Mm-hmm. They're based in Milan.
And I think, as you said, there's a slightly sort of a little more maturity to it. I would also say even I think a greater deployment on sort of, you know, paper and the manufacturing process, just the bit that you're referencing there as well, Charlotte. We've got time for one more magazine, Sam, before we go. What you've got two to choose from there.
Yeah, very, very briefly. A different kind of magazine altogether. The New York Review of Books was the other thing on my table this morning and seemed timely in that it's 50 years since it was founded by Robert B. Silvers, who continues to be the editor and edits every piece. And Charlotte and I were speculating earlier, I think he may still even design the cover, perhaps, which is a triumph of anti-design. You know, it hasn't really changed very much in 50 years. And it still continues to be a remarkable review, and I read every issue.
And just the eclecticism, because in many ways, I mean, this is another title, which also sort of, you see sort of review, et cetera, and I'm always surprised at how incredibly newsy and topical they can be as well.
It is. I mean, in terms of heavy-hitting reporters, you have people like Mark Danner reporting on torture from one end, but then through to people like Sanford Schwartz reporting on whatever's on the Met, you know, any given week. So it really does have an incredible breadth and came out of a very specific scene. Robert Lowell, the poet, was one of the other founders, and his then-wife, the writer Elizabeth Hardwick. And it still has that kind of New York sensibility, which as a European, I find so seductive.
Yeah, and you know, you were talking at the top as well about just that sense of long form. And I can remember, you know, I guess it was almost 15 years ago that I remember Elaine Scar did an incredible story about this investigation with the crash of Swiss Air Flight 111, which I guess its anniversary, 15th anniversary should be this week, in fact. And so you picked this up and you thought, you know, this could have been a piece which, you know, could have lived very well in the New Yorker or it could have lived well in any number of, in fact, Sunday newspapers wouldn't have done it as well in this country. And they've got, you know, really the time and luxury to also let these things breathe.
Absolutely, yeah, and they can publish something like that by Scarry, who is, you know, this isn't her main subject, you know, I don't know how she picked that up, but that was a main project of hers for some time, but as you say, it has a place here, but it also has an essay by Martin Scorsese on the early days of cinema. Mm.
To both of you, both Sam Thorne, good luck with the project.
Thank you.
It sounds absolutely fantastic, and I'm sure we'll be getting someone else out there to cover that as well. Also, Charlotte Ray from Acne Paper. Thanks for that. Next week, we're going to have a special story off the back, of course, of Visa pour l'image. We're going to be talking not just photojournalism, but we'll also be talking about the broader issues of conflict coverage with our special guest next week. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and behind the glass in the studio or other side of the studio was Claire Urban. If you have any comments or thoughts for today's show, then please drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, goodbye.